From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and it's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this last week. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter with the Idaho Statesman, Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun, and Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com. I want to welcome all of you to the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, everyone. All right. I would like to start with the very latest with COVID-19. I mean, even though a lot of folks believe that it is over, that is not necessarily the case when we look at our positive case counts. And Melissa, I know over at Idaho Reports, you did an entire podcast this week on this, about this current wave. So can you talk to us first, Melissa, about the positivity rates, but then also why this wave looks a bit different?
Well, first, the good news, state positivity is coming down, and most areas that test wastewater are seeing either plateaus or drops in their numbers. So that's the good news. But Idaho has, as you know, surpassed 5,000 deaths, and we've recently seen cases creep up statewide, not on the documented levels of the Delta or Omicron surges, but we wanted to check in with how hospitals are doing. So we set up an interview with North Idaho's Panhandle Health District, their public information officer. The Panhandle has seen the highest COVID death rate over the course of the pandemic. They recently had positivity rates that were higher than the statewide average, and they were the first to enter crisis standards of care during the Delta wave last fall. They are also seeing a slight rise in their wastewater testing while the rest of the state is going down. You know, she said what we've heard elsewhere, that this variant is highly transmissible, but it isn't causing severe illness in the vast majority of people who contract it. They have seen an increase in hospitalizations, but nowhere near at the same level as Delta last year. So still, even if it's a very small percentage of people who are getting severely ill, if you have a lot of people who get the virus, you know, if the denominator is high, the numerator is going to be high as well. With that increase in hospitalizations, we've seen a commensurate increase in ICU admissions and pediatric admissions. Again, comparatively smaller than what we saw last year, but still more than what we've seen since those numbers came down after that initial Omicron wave this year. So the message is the same. As we head into the fall months in the school year, stay home if you're sick, consider wearing a mask, consider getting vaccinated.
And Audrey, I want to bring you into the conversation because Dr. Ryan Cole has been a controversial figure during the entire pandemic. First off, give us a bit of background if folks aren't familiar with who we're talking about, but then the latest in regards to complaints that have been filed about his medical license.
Yeah, and this dovetails pretty well with the COVID stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So Ryan Cole is a pathologist who owns a regional laboratory in Garden City, and he also was appointed to the Central District Health Board. So the public health board that's the largest in the state, it handles vaccination and other kinds of things for Boise and all of Ada County. So he has become a regular on speaking circuit of the various groups that have kind of emerged saying that the COVID vaccines are not something people should take and that COVID can be treated with ivermectin and all of those kinds of claims. And so there were complaints filed against him in, I believe, 3 or 4 states at this point. Mm-hmm. And one of them was in Washington. Washington is the only state in the U.S. where you can actually get access to the records of a physician who is the subject of disciplinary investigation or complaints. And in any other state, you cannot get that information. You can't get the complaint. You can't get the investigatory information until or unless a disciplinary action has actually been filed. So this is kind of unprecedented access for us. You cannot get this stuff in Idaho, but you can get these records in Washington, in the state of Washington. So I did obtain his response to the complaints that had been filed to the Washington Medical Commission. And, you know, previously it's been, he has not really responded to my queries for a while. And, so this was the first time we got really a substantive, large response. And his lawyer, wrote a very lengthy letter. He wrote a bit of an overview. And so it was a 40-page total package that they sent to the medical commission in defense of his practices and his public speaking. So bringing you up to speed. He basically, and his attorney basically said, hey, this is kind of a freedom of speech issue. He is a very well-educated person, which is very true, very well-educated, very well-trained. And these are his professional opinions. And he believes that the public should hear about the things that he is seeing, regardless of, you know, whether there are scientific studies out there on answering these questions. These hypothetical or hypotheses he has. So the problem was that many of the claims that were in that letter, the arguments made in that letter, don't jive with the public statements that he's made. And I've taken down many of his public statements and speeches and things like that. And so we were able to show, you know, this is where he said that it will cause, you know, various ailments or death. So if anybody wants to read through all that, it's at idahocapitalsun.com.
Okay. I do appreciate that update. I know it's a lot. Nicole, I want to switch gears a bit. Idaho's abortion ban is set to go into effect on August 25th. However, Planned Parenthood did just file another lawsuit against the state. So this is the third lawsuit. What do we know?
So this lawsuit is really similar to the second lawsuit that was filed at the end of last month. So the first lawsuit that Planned Parenthood filed was way back in March when the state went forward with Senate Bill, I think 1309, which would allow for family members to sue healthcare providers who perform abortions. Mm-hmm. The second one came right after the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs that overturned Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And that one was challenging basically a total abortion ban in Idaho. The only exceptions would be for people who are pregnant and their life is at risk because of the pregnancy, and for people who are victims of rape or incest and have reported those crimes to law enforcement. So this third one is kind of covering all the bases. It sort of addresses the other eventuality that could take place in Idaho, which would be say this total abortion ban gets thrown out, there would still be what's called a fetal heartbeat bill, where it would be illegal for medical providers to perform abortions after what is called a fetal heartbeat, which has also been described by healthcare professionals as more accurately electrical activity. So if someone performed an abortion after that electrical activity was detected, that would be a felony. So they're sort of covering all their bases and saying, okay, we've gone for the total abortion ban, but there was another case decided on another heartbeat bill. And so we want to make sure that if Idaho's heartbeat law tries to come into play, that we've challenged that one as well.
Okay. And Melissa, can I bring you in for a minute? Because we are waiting, are we not? I believe next week, when these cases will be brought in front of the Idaho Supreme Court, but it's not necessarily to decide them.
No, it's not to decide them at all. It is to consider whether or not the court should stay them while the cases make their way through the courts. In other words, whether they should stop them from going into effect before the court decides. The court is also deciding whether or not the cases should be combined and heard at the same time. And it will consider whether or not they should be remanded to a lower court instead of being, you know, going right in front of the Supreme Court. So these aren't oral arguments on the merits of the case. Rather, it's kind of a procedural act because there are so many laws, as Nicole just described, and they're all entwined with each other. And there are now three lawsuits that they're going to have to decide how to handle those.
Okay. Margaret, we all know that gas prices have been high. They are trending down around the country right now. I only had to pay right under $5 the other day, a gallon. But gas retailers here in the Treasure Valley are, you've reported on this, they're making record-breaking profits, but yet the Attorney General's office can't investigate anything. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, for sure. So the Attorney General's office, every week, they review data that shows, okay, what's the difference between what gas retailers are buying gas for on the wholesale market and what they're selling it for? And we call that a margin. So the difference between the amount of cents that is difference, but the difference between what they buy it for and what you pay at the pump. Before the pandemic, you know, and pretty typically we saw a lot of margins that were 10 cents, you know, per gallon of gas, all that sort of stuff. And even, you know, in May, earlier this year, we saw lower margins, 10 cents. And even at one point, gas retail, when prices were quite high, gas retailers were selling slightly at a loss. Well, now, whenever gas prices are still up, data from the Attorney General's office shows that there's was a 66 cents difference between what they're paying on the wholesale market and what they're selling it for. And this is actually a higher margin than whenever the AG's office investigated gas retailers for price gouging back in 2020. So But the difference now is there's two differences why the AG can't investigate. First, we are out. We no longer have an emergency declaration for COVID-19. That is over. And whenever those emergency declarations are over, it means the Price Gouging Consumer Protection Act is no longer in play. So that's obviously not in play. But they also can't investigate margins at all, even if we were an investigation, because after the AG did that investigation and got a $1.5 million settlement after three large gas companies, their industry association got a bill passed out of the Idaho legislature that said the AG's office can no longer use those margins as evidence of price gouging. And it severely limited what evidence the AG can even look at in order to conduct something like that.
So Nicole, you and your colleagues at the Idaho Statesman recently published a series about extremism and white nationalism here in Idaho. Can you tell us about what you found out in regards to anti-government extremism and Idaho being basically an enclave for some people? And I have to tell you, when I read these articles, it reminded me of what happened in the 80s and the 90s, and frankly, what Idaho was known for in North Idaho with white nationalism.
Yeah, I heard in reporting this, I heard a lot of kind of similarities between what we're seeing now and how folks up north felt when the Aryan Nations compound was still active. So it was a two-part series that I worked with, actually with a reporter from Washington, D.C. His name's Michael Wilner. He works for the Statesman's parent company, McClatchy. And so Michael looked at more of the anti-government extremism part of things, kind of online activism, and how these groups are targeting Idaho. So he spoke with some Department of Homeland Security folks who said that they do have evidence that Idaho is specifically being targeted for kind of anti-government extremist conspiracy theory messaging, particularly on the internet because of its history. He also, you know, spoke with some researchers who have found that nearly a quarter of our state legislators have some sort of tie or connection, often through social media, to groups that have or are espousing these kinds of conspiracy theories, whether that is anti-government theories, theories about the 2020 election, theories about COVID. So that was really eye-opening. And I think one official called Idaho like a microcosm of the alt-right in America, which was, I thought, a really interesting quote. And then my section of things focused a little bit more on kind of the violent extremism, I guess. So I looked into a couple of people who have moved to Idaho in the hopes of finding what one man called an ethnic enclave or an ethnostate. And so these are people who have ties to organizations like the Proud Boys, which is categorized as a hate group by a lot of organizations that study hate groups and extremism. And this individual had talked about, you know, wanting to create a safe space for white people and encouraging other white people to move to Idaho and increase those demographics here, and, you know, brought up a lot of concerns or kind of fear-mongered about a race war and some other like pretty violent stuff. And this is an individual who has a history of some violent offenses, including assault. He's currently being investigated for a charge of battery on a healthcare worker in Boise.
And I found interesting too, Nicole, in your reporting, was the comparison, as we mentioned, between what we saw with the Aryan Nations in the 80s and 90s in North Idaho, and the fact that citizens spoke up, right? They spoke up, they spoke out. And one individual you interviewed, you know, said, we're not seeing as much of that today.
Sure. So Mike Satz, who's the director of the Idaho 97 Project, it's kind of a newer organization that aims to get rid of misinformation in politics, among other things. He was very direct in saying, you know, I don't see what we saw in North Idaho, where there is a community that is very much coming together and saying this is not acceptable. And, you know, I spoke with the folks with the Kootenai County Commission on Human Rights, who were completely integral to ousting the Aryan Nations back in the early 2000s. And yeah, that community element is something that I heard over and over again, that we do as communities need to come together and say, even if we can agree with, you know, even if we find a little bit of common ground on one thing, if somebody has these extremist views that are, you know, that are racist, that are anti-Semitic, we need to come out and tell them none of that is acceptable, even if, you know, I can find a tiny overlap in something that you're saying at some point.
And Nicole, did they give any, did when you interviewed Mike Satz, did you give any reasons as to why maybe we're seeing that? Because I wonder if it is because we see such backlash when people do speak up and speak out right now, right? We've seen it with when these groups don't like something, they don't just protest. They show up at people's homes. There is a fear, I think, of violence and retaliation.
Sure. And that's something that, you know, Michael Wilner touched on in his story. He spoke with Diana Lacciando, the former Ada County Commissioner, and she was on the health board for Central District Health. And he spoke with her about what it was like having people protest outside of her home when Central District Health was considering mask mandates and other kind of COVID precautions. So I definitely think that could be part of it. I know that the Aryan Nations were violent. And so I think that there probably was some community fear back when that organization was operational. I think a lot of it also has to do probably with the way that these conversations are being had. A lot of it's happening online. And I think a lot of people learn about it online and they feel like they can maybe spectate, or like they don't have an idea of precisely where it's taking place in their community. Whereas, you know, in the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, when the Aryan Nations was active, there was a physical compound. There were people marching in the streets. There was something that I think felt a lot more physically present for that community.
That makes sense. Melissa, talk to us about former Idaho lawmaker Aaron Von Ellinger. He was set to be sentenced earlier this week. He was convicted of rape. The sentencing didn't happen, though.
Von Ellinger's lawyer asked that it be put off and had filed motions to ask the judge to either agree to their request to either retry or acquit Von Ellinger. So Ruth Brown, our producer at Idaho Reports, has been covering the story pretty closely. This doesn't mean that the sentencing won't happen. It's just that on August 25th, Judge Michael Reardon has agreed to hear arguments on the motion for a new trial or acquittal. Until then, Von Ellinger will remain in custody, and we'll see what happens then. We'll continue to cover it.
Okay. Margaret, the U.S. Senate passed the CHIPS Act. This could potentially be good news for Micron, but both of our senators, Risch and Folger, voted no on this. And I think that's got some folks kind of scratching their heads. So can you kind of explain, first off, what this act is? And let's go from there in regards to, you know, why our senators would have voted no on this and what it could possibly mean for Micron.
The CHIPS Act is a key focus for President Biden, and it would provide huge financial incentives for semiconductor companies to expand manufacturing here in the United States. If you're not familiar with semiconductors, they're on a very basic level. They are the computer chips that make all of our entire lives work. And the Biden administration is saying that having domestic production of these sorts of chips is key to national security. We've seen a shortage of these chips, and that's why we've seen prices on things like cars just hike in the last year. And right now we rely on Taiwan to produce a lot of these chips. And so obviously Taiwan is in the orbit of China, our main ally, so or not ally, rival on the world stage. So that's that. So this is a geopolitical conflict, really. And so the CHIPS Act would provide all of these incentives. And the U.S. Department of Commerce has said that if the CHIPS Act passed, Micron has a possibility of expanding here in Boise to build a fabrication plant. They confirmed that last week, I believe, or maybe the week before. And but our delegation, all four members of our congressional delegation voted against it. In their statements, the statements that we have available, they said that they supported the semiconductor industry and wanted to see it expand in the United States, but they were frustrated by Democrats adding in extra spending into these bills, you know, tying in other items to the semiconductor bill. And that is something that happens a lot in Congress, where folks will be trying to pass a bill that is important to everyone in the room, and they'll slip in all these other projects in there and all these other spending in an effort to get that stuff passed. And so to stop things from getting caught in a logjam. And so that's something that our Republicans did not appreciate. They didn't like the extra spending that came with the bill, so they voted it down. But there were, you know, other set Republicans who did vote for it. It did pass as a bipartisan effort, although not overwhelmingly bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to head to President Joe Biden here soon, very likely.
Okay. Reclaim Idaho has gotten another initiative on the ballot. This time it will be the Quality Education Act. We will see it in November. But Melissa, there are now some questions over how it will impact tax legislation that was passed this year, correct?
Correct. This is a little complicated to explain. I'll do my best. Once again, our producer, Ruth Brown, has covered this. So for the full rundown, go to Idaho Reports Online. But basically, the language of the initiative was based on tax statute language that was in place in 2021 when they started circulating the petition and gathering signatures. During the 2022 session, as you recall, the legislature passed and the governor signed record-breaking tax breaks. They consolidated the tax brackets from 5 to 4. The argument put forth by the national nonprofit think tank, the Tax Foundation, is that because the initiative was based on the 2021 language, that it would reverse those tax cuts And so I think most all Idahoans got some sort of income tax relief with that from the legislature. The argument is that that would then be reversed. We would go back to the 2021 statute language. And so the tax increase wouldn't just affect individuals who make more than $250,000 and married couples who make $500,000. It would then affect everybody. The Reclaim Idaho group has denied this. They have said that no, all we're adding is this new tax bracket for that group that I just mentioned. There is potentially another problem with this, though, that Brian Kane, the chief deputy attorney general, agreed with the tax foundation's analysis, that basically the numerator and the denominator for the inflation, like I said, I'm trying to explain this the best I can.
No, I get it.
That it has been flipped, which means that as inflation happens, the less money you make, the more likely you are to be affected by this tax increase. And okay. So once again, Luke Mayville of Reclaim Idaho has said that if any state agency or the legislature tries to hold up this statute, should it pass, then they will take the issue to court and it would be settled there. But once again, it would have to be passed by voters in November in the first place. We're already seeing a lot of people gearing up for this fight. So I think it's going to be a pretty electric general election.
Oh, I think so. So Audrey, just last week, the United States saw its first case of polio in, I believe, about a decade. This happened back east. This person was not vaccinated for the polio vaccine. So you did some digging into Idaho's polio vaccination rate, and what did you find?
Yeah, it had been a while since we'd gotten the, you know, school by school vaccination rates. And so I asked Health and Welfare if they could, please let me have that data. But I looked at polio rates individually, vaccination rates, and I looked at the overall vaccination rates. Those are in a searchable database, by the way, for folks who have children in elementary schools. They're based on the kindergarten rates, but since most kindergartners are, up to date on their shots with their early childhood vaccinations, they're pretty good indicators of that school's vaccination rate. Anyway, so our polio vaccination rates have gone down over the past 10 years. And pretty significantly in the last school year. And there's been an increase in the number or rate of parents filing exemptions. And of course, Idaho has one of the most liberal policies for vaccination exemptions. You can exempt your child for any reason. And in fact, schools have to tell parents that they can exempt their child, as opposed to just, the parent having to find out about that. So that has been something that's been on people's minds. You know, polio's one of those diseases that when we're talking about vaccine hesitancy and the kind of the pullback on vaccinating children, that's among still a small minority of people. When we're talking about that, polio comes up a lot because it's very visible. It's still in modern memory. And nobody wants to see that come back. Polio was eradicated. And in this case, it was a man who had traveled to another country where they use a certain type of vaccine that we actually don't use in the US. And he got infected with that strain anyway. So it does not appear that he caught it here. The problem is, if you have low vaccination rates in your community, you don't have that, what we call herd immunity. So if we have more situations like this, we need to make sure that we have enough children vaccinated so that that doesn't become an issue. It doesn't start spreading again. And we're getting awfully close to that threshold, which is 80 to 85% generally. We're at 86% of kindergartners being vaccinated against polio. So So we're getting really close to that threshold where we know children are vaccinated from or are protected from this disease, which can paralyze or even kill children.
And Margaret, I want to wrap up with you. I only have about a minute left, but what's going on with this proposed subdivision in the outskirts of CUNA that the city of CUNA said no to about 2 years ago?
In 2020, CUNA City Council got an application and they took a long time to consider it to build 2,200 homes out in the outskirts of the city near Falcon Crest Golf Course. And they ultimately decided on a narrow vote to say, no, we can't afford to serve this. It's too far. It's too expensive. And now the developer has said, okay, fine. I'm gonna just apply with Ada County, which would to build my subdivision. And so we're going to see, and that's going to be a decision for Ada County to make to decide, Do they have the money to serve a 2,200 subdivision on the outskirts in this area? And that will be a real test for the commissioners we have to see how they're feeling about the cost of services, balancing private enterprise, all sorts of stuff.
And so, Margaret, when will this come in front of the county commission? Do we know?
We don't know yet, but they are expected to submit their initial application in the coming weeks. And then after that, the clock will tick. And I would assume that the Ada County will review the application for several months before we even have a hearing. Yeah. So there'll be a long time for this to wind up.
All right. I want to thank all of you for being on the program today and for the great reporting that you all do with all of your newsrooms. So thank you to Melissa Davlin, the host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, Nicole Blanchard, outdoors reporter with the Idaho Statesman, and Audrey Dutton, senior investigative reporter with the Idaho Capital Sun. Appreciate all of you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Jenna.
Thank you.